Hi everyone, I'm back. Laszlo Montgomery here with another episode in our shallow but generally satisfying dive into the history of Xinjiang. Episode 251 this time, Xinjiang History Part 8. Lots of interesting stuff to cover today, 10th to the 13th centuries. Last time we looked at the rise and fall of the Uyghur Khaganate, 744 to 840. After putting away their Karluk and Basmil allies, the Uyghurs got to enjoy being the next great power to be rulers of the Eastern Eurasian steppe, joining all those others who came before and after them to lord it over this part of Asia. Though it had never been part of China, these lands to the north, since the earliest days of recorded Chinese history, had so much impact on many of the events of northern China. But like everyone before them, going back to the Xiongnu, the Uyghurs, too, fell to a greater power, the ancient Kyrgyz from lands even beyond northwestern Mongolia, along the Yenisei River. After decades of trying, they conquered the Uyghurs and forced them south and west from their traditional Mongolian homeland. And these Yenisei Kyrgyz became the next great power of the Mongolian steppe, but not the last. So let's focus on the Uyghur diaspora sent packing from their ancestral homeland. I mentioned in closing last time, some of these Uyghurs ended up in Gansu, some in Xinjiang, and some in Qinghai. Our focus will be on the ones who ended up in Xinjiang, the Kocho Uyghur Kingdom. Let me just say I use the term Uyghurs in the general sense. Even within the Uyghur people, there were various clans, and, you know, the thing about clans, those people stick together. And it was one of those clans that ended up in Gansu. And in Gansu province, they got themselves settled and established a political organization right in the middle of the Hexi, or Gansu Corridor, the front door to Xinjiang from the China side. The Uyghur kingdom in Gansu was called the Ganzhou Uyghur Kingdom. Ganzhou is located in present-day Zhangye, historic Gansu province. I read Kublai Khan was born in Zhangye. This group of Uyghurs established their own kingdom in 894 that lasted clear through to 1036. But when this branch of the Uyghur diaspora arrived in Gansu province, someone was already there. Let me quickly mention them first. Their story is related to the fall of the Tang. The Tang dynasty finally up and died in 907. They had been mostly gone from Xinjiang since even before 790. Their bete noire, the Tibetan Empire, had been too great a foe for the Tang throughout the 7th, 8th, and 9th centuries. But just as the Uyghur Khaganate was starting to crumble mid-9th century, it was also the beginning of the end of the Tibetan Empire, as they too fell victim to the same old thing that brought down many an empire, dynasty, and political party, namely succession problems. As the Tibetan Empire was starting to topple, they were completely pushed out of the Hexi Corridor in Gansu province by Chinese troops based in what was then called Shazhou or Sha Prefecture. This is present-day Dunhuang. And this land in the Gansu Corridor that had belonged to Tibet was seized back and put under Tang Dynasty control. And this was in the 780s. And the one who led this victorious army was named Zhang Yichao. For all his achievements in putting this crucial territory back under the Chinese flag, he was given military rank and honors by the Tang Xuanzong Emperor that effectively turned him into the military governor of this region in the Hexi Corridor. And this area became known as the Guiyi Circuit, or Guiyi Jun. And the dates of this Guiyi Jun are 848 to 1036. And although within the Guiyi Jun there was some infighting that saw different families controlling the politics, this entity remained loyal to the Chinese Empire, first under the Tang and later under the Song. The Ganzhou Uyghur Kingdom dates are 894 to 1036. Same ending date as the Guiyi Circuit. And beginning around 910 to 916, these Ganzhou Uyghurs wrested away part of these lands controlled by the Guiyi Circuit in Zhangye, and then they went and formed their own Uyghur Ganzhou Kingdom. The Ganzhou Uyghurs were friendly with these other power centers in North China, and they maintained very good relations with the Song court. The Guiyi Circuit and the Ganzhou Uyghur Kingdom both ended up getting swallowed up in the same year by the same entity. And these were the Tangut tribes who founded the Western Xia Dynasty, 1038 to 1227. The Tanguts were people who came from around the Tibetan Plateau, and their dynasty, the Western Xia, well, it ran concurrently with the Northern Song and Liao dynasties, and was centered around Shanxi, Ningxia, and Gansu, running west all the way to the Jade Gate, the Yumen, where China proper unofficially ended. Genghis Khan will end up dying in his battles to conquer this Western Xia. The Ganzhou Uyghurs, after meeting their end against the Western Xia, did what everyone else did, going all the way back to the Xiongnu. They assembled as one single horde and migrated to land stretching from Dunhuang in the north to northern Qinghai in the south, as well as parts of the southern Tarim Basin. And these people became known as the so-called Yellowhead Uyghurs, the Huangtou Huihe, or Huihu. They weren't a warlike people and pretty much minded their own business, practiced Buddhism. And these Yellowhead Uyghurs are thought to be today's Uyghur ethnic minority, Y-U-G-U-R, not Uyghur. They are the Yuguzhu, one of the official 56. There's about 15,000 or so who claim that ethnicity on their ID cards, mostly living in and around Zhangye and Gansu. So with the Guiyi Circuit and Ganzhou Uyghur Kingdom out of the way, let's look at the Kocho Uyghur Kingdom. The Uyghurs of this kingdom were pretty important because they were the ones who settled in Xinjiang and called the place home for the next 1,000 years or so. So this group from the Uyghur diaspora pushed out of their Mongolian homeland by the Yenisei Kyrgyz. The greatest number of them ended up in Xinjiang. First to Beshbalik, or Beiting, as we've called it before, which acted as the winter capital of their kingdom, and also to the south in Kocho, which, as I said, we've also known as Gaochang and Karakoja, among other names. The Uyghurs were fortunate in that, well, as I said, the Tibetans, who had controlled these lands for the past 100 years, were already having a steep decline in their fortunes as an empire. And this made the Uyghur takeover of the Turpan and North Tarim basins that much easier. This new Uyghur Kocho kingdom stretched from about Hami in the Turpan Basin to Kucha in the west, some 700 miles away, mostly all of the northern Tarim Basin. And when these Uyghurs, who, thanks to their former Kagan, Burgu, you know, mainly followed the faith of Manichaeism, well, when they arrived in Xinjiang, the place was still overwhelmingly Buddhist. And after a while, much to Burgu Kagan's chagrin, had he lived to see it, the Uyghurs of Kocho began to transition from Manichaeism to Buddhism, beginning in the 9th and 10th centuries. So the Kocho Uyghurs, they built themselves quite a magical kingdom up in the northern portion of the Tarim Basin. It was multi-ethnic, rich, diverse, and a land of many faiths, all of which seemed to tolerate the other, though Islam was not part of this mix yet. This land where the Kocho Kingdom lay is also referred to historically as Uyghuristan, and these Uyghurs at this age are sometimes referred to as the medieval Uyghurs. The Kocho Uyghur Kingdom lasted for quite a long time, all the way to 1130, at which time they fell under the yoke of the Karakhitai. And we'll get to them in good time. Istan, that's a Persian word that means land. There's 7 countries, all in Central Asia, whose names end in stan or istan. So Uyghuristan, the Uyghurs' land, or the land of the Uyghurs. Something of note from the early Song that's worth mentioning. In 981 or 982, by order of the Song Taizong Emperor, brother to the founder, Zhao Kuangyin. Well, like other emperors had done before him, most famously perhaps Han Wu Di with Zhang Qian, well, he also sent an envoy to the west to explore relations with the kingdoms out that way. And this is the story of Wang Yende. He lived from 939 to 1006. By 984, Wang Yende made it to the Turpan Basin, to the Kocho Kingdom, And he had this to say about the place, and I'm quoting from James Millward's great book, which I strongly recommend for further reading on this subject, Eurasian Crossroads. Quote, "There is no rain or snow here, and it is extremely hot. Each year at the hottest time, the inhabitants dig holes in the ground to live in. The earth produces all five grains except buckwheat. The nobility eat horseflesh, while the rest eat mutton, wild ducks, and geese. Their music is played on the pipa and the harp. They produce sables, fine white cotton cloth, and an embroidered cloth made from flower stamens. By custom, they enjoy horseback riding and archery. They use the Tang calendar. They fashion pipes of silver or brass and channel flowing water to shoot at each other. Or they sprinkle water on each other as a game, which they call pressing out the sun's heat to chase off sickness. They like to take walks, and the strollers always carry a musical instrument with them. There are over 50 Buddhist temples here, the names inscribed over the gates, all presented by the Tang court. On spring nights, the locals pass the time milling about between the temples. In this land, there are no poor people. Anyone short of food is given public aid. People live to an advanced age, generally over 100 years. No one dies young." End quote. Well, except for the lack of buckwheat, doesn't sound like such a bad place. These Uyghurs who made their new home in Xinjiang, well, over time, they mingled and married with the Xinjiang local people of various backgrounds, Sogdian, Chinese, Indian, other Turkic people, Tibetans, and other Indo-European people who had populated these lands since 2000 BCE. And not only the physical characteristics of the inhabitants were combined, the different cultures and many linguistic elements as well impacted what this place ultimately became. And over a millennium, what evolved are the Uyghur people that you see today. And I can't speak for all of them, but most Uyghur inhabitants of Xinjiang today got there as a result of this great diaspora that followed in the wake of the fall of the Uyghur Khaganate in 840. Regardless of the purity of Uyghur strands and the people who lived in the Kocho Kingdom, they all shared one single Uyghur political identity. There's quite a lot that has been preserved that shows this place was among the great literary and scholarly regions of the day. The Indo-Iranic Sogdian script became a literary vehicle for the Turkic spoken Uyghur language to express itself even more eloquently. The Uyghur Buddhists who thrived here during the 10th and 11th century, you know, left behind a lot of writings. Again, all in that Sogdian script they had adopted. These were a much more refined and scholarly group of Uyghurs than what had once populated their Mongolian homeland. In the mid-11th century came two of the more renowned literary figures of the Kocho Kingdom period. These were Yusuf Has Hajib and Mahmud al-Kashgari. If you have a 1,000 Kyrgyz psalm note in your wallet, that's Yusuf Has Hajib's face you see. He wrote a work called The Wisdom That Brings Happiness, a beautifully written work that provides a very detailed window into the society he lived in, which in the 1050s was the Karakhanid Khanate that we're going to look at in a bit. Mahmud al-Kashgari, he too lived during the Karakhanid Khanate, and as his name suggests, he came from Kashgar. He was another giant literary figure from his time. He's most renowned for his work, A Dictionary of Turkic Languages, that has offered scholars insight into so much of the literary works, including Turkic poetry, and like the other surviving works of this time, it offers precious insight into what was happening in the Karakhanid Khanate. Historians will offer the context and the chronologies, but it was the literary people of these times who filled in so many blanks as far as what a place was actually like. A historian will tell you, place existed, the poet adds the human element to the structure. So Yusuf Has Hajib and Mahmud al-Kashgari were two of the more important literary figures from this time. At the same time that the Kocho Uyghur Kingdom was thriving in the north of Xinjiang, northern Tarim Basin and Turpan Basin, a new power arrived on the scene. These were the Karakhanids. This group traced their most recent history to the Karluks. The Karluks We were another Turkic tribe. Remember, the Karluks were occasional military allies of the Tang Dynasty and were called upon from time to time to do the bidding of the Tang Emperor. But at the Battle of Talas, 751, it was these very same Karluks who switched sides on Gaoxianzhe and forced the Tang army to go down in defeat against the Arabs and flee to lands west of Xinjiang. The Karluks had also once been one-third of the alliance that teamed up with the Uyghurs to overthrow the eastern Turkic Khaganate. But alliances in that part of the world were never terribly long-lasting, and the Karluks got chased out of those Mongolian lands and ended up in western Xinjiang and also in eastern Kyrgyzstan. There, these Karluks and other Turkic tribes they made alliances with along the way set up their political state that we know as the Karakhanid Khanate. After playing a role in the defeat of the western Turkic Khaganate, they established their capital at Suyab, the Chinese Suiye, where the Tang protectorate once was relocated for a while after Talas, and when the Karakhanids arrived in and around Transoxiana. There were many contenders already fighting amongst themselves for control of these lands, made so rich over the centuries by the ever-expanding volume of trade between East and West. And with so many players from near and far, well, alliances were always made between the stronger and weaker powers of Central Asia. And the Karluks led the way in the establishment of the Karakhanid Khanate. And the dates of the Karakhanids was 840 to 1212. If that year 840 rang a familiar bell, that was also the same year of the fall of the Uyghur Khaganate. Again, the Karluks and the Uyghurs were both ethnically Turkic. Compared to their relative importance and impact on the history of Central Asia, the Karakhanid Khanate doesn't get the attention it deserves. They had a very major role in the spread of Islam throughout the region, including in Xinjiang, which I guess you could say exerted a huge influence on the events that followed into our modern day. How the one-time Buddhist Karakhanids embraced Islam requires the telling of the story of the 10th century Karakhanid prince Sultan Satuk Bugra Khan. Although of the Karakhanids, he was not a Karluk Turk. He came from a different tribe who had joined with the Karluks to assist in the founding of the Khanate. He came from just a little north of Kashgar. When he was young, his stepfather, the Khan, was tolerant of Muslims, and they roamed where they pleased. The Khan even allowed them to build a mosque in Artush, next city north of Kashgar. During this time of Satuk Bugra Khan, the Persian Samanid Empire was in full swing. That ran from 819 to 999. And these Samanids were a major group of Muslims who you had a good chance of running into this far east into Central Asia. The Samanids were later conquered by the Karakhanids. And Satuk Bugra Khan, when he became the ruler of this Khanate, he converted to Islam in 934. That was the milestone year for the establishment of Islam as the predominant faith of this massive part of the world. Satuk Bugra Khan then went on to allow Islam to be introduced throughout the Khanate and, in fact, was a benefactor of the religion. And thanks to him, we remember the Karakhanid Khanate as not only the first Turkic Islamic empire in Central Asia. It was the Karakhanids who, for the first time, took traditional Turkic culture and merged it with Islam. And as you'll see, Islam took Central Asia by storm. And where there were once Buddhist centers and a proliferation of temples, over the 10th and 11th centuries, they faded in importance and in the numbers of faithful. And the Buddhist temples made way for mosques. And what we see today all came from this time in history. Believe me, there are plenty of differing stories about how Abdul Karim Satuk Bugra Khan converted to Islam. One of these stories suggests he was strongly affected by seeing the Muslim faithful, as I said, probably Samanid Persians, at prayer. And at the age of 12, against his stepfather the Khan's wishes, he converted to Islam. And after Satuk Bugra Khan killed his stepfather for his hard line against his practice of Islam, he became the new Khan of the Karakhanids. And as I said, gave Islam its very own great leap forward in this part of the world. And if you go to Artush, next town north of Kashgar today, you can visit the tomb of Satuk Bugra Khan. Not a very well-known name in the West, but had quite a big impact on world history, particularly in Central Asia. The Karakhanid armies at the end of the 10th and early 11th centuries began to take over the southern kingdoms of the Tarim Basin, most notably the kingdom of Khotan, the rich and prosperous land, also known as Yutian, and today called Hetian. It was one of the greatest and longest-lasting Buddhist centers within 1,000 miles. Unlike on the opposite side of the Tarim Basin, these Khotanese and the kingdoms east and west of them had always been more Iranic culturally and linguistically. The kingdom they created in the year 56 ran for 950 years before their end came. They had, for a while at least, managed to remain independent of both the Kocho Uyghur kingdom in the north and from the Karakhanids in the west. Buddhist Khotan and Muslim Karakhanid fought a long war. But in 1006, it was all over for this one-time commercial, cultural, and Buddhist paradise. And with the takeover of Khotan, what followed was a quick introduction of Islam to this Buddhist land, eventually turning it into what you see in modern times. As far back as when Marco Polo passed through in the early 1270s, he noted Khotan was already a Muslim land. Early 11th century, the Karakhanid Khanates began to fall apart. And since the 1040s, their empire had already been divided up into East and West. No one in the family can get along, same old story. The Khanate had already peaked by then. At the dawn of the 1200s, there were four powers in Central Asia jostling each other for political control over their respective lands. Between the Western and Eastern Karakhanids, there were also the Seljuk Turks, the Khwarezmian dynasty, and the Karakhitai coming right up. In the end, the Eastern Karakhanids in 1211 were done in by the Karakhitai, and then 2 years later, the Western Karakhanid Khanate was defeated by an alliance led by the Khwarezmian dynasty. The familiar 13th century, the 1200s, the Mongol century. Well, pretty soon they're going to put everyone out of business, and all lands we've been talking about, directly and indirectly, in Asia, will belong to them. And monumental software changes will start to happen in every corner of the continent. So the Karakhanid Khanate, these were mostly Karluk Turks and their subjects. You know, maybe we don't think of them as much as we ought to. Their achievements between 840 and 1212 acted as the catalyst in their day that blended the Turkic nomadic aspect of who they originally were with the Islamic faith that they embraced in 934 with Satuk Bugra Khan, along with the culture of these long-established oasis states that have been around since the earliest days of the Silk Road. This Karakhanid Khanate give a nice bump to this wave of momentum that saw not only the Islamization of the Tarim Basin, but the Turkicization as well. What followed their time on the historical stage, among other things, was that, in Xinjiang at least, the people became heavily Turkic in their makeup, and, well, this is also when Buddhism, that had once so dominated the entire Asian continent, gradually vanished from the basins, replaced instead with Islam. The Karakhitai were the next great power to dominate Eastern Eurasia, including Xinjiang. Easy to get them mixed up with the Karakhanid. Not the same. The Karakhitai were not Turkic people. They were Khitan, or Chitan, from lands in Eastern Mongolia, parts of Siberia, and Northern Manchuria. They spoke an Altaic language, their own, called the Khitan language. If you recall, we looked at the Khitans back in an old CHP episode, number 126. This was the story of the founder of the great Liao dynasty, Yelü Apaoji. The Yelü clan were the dominant clan amongst these Khitan people. And after the Khitans had become a great power in the north, well, that's when Yelü Apaoji formed the Liao dynasty, that ran from the fall of the Tang, 916, to 1125. During that time, they were the greatest power in northern China and Manchuria, as well as parts of Mongolia. They were permanently defeated by the Jurchens of the Qin Dynasty, the very same ones who also, in 1125, snuffed out the northern Song and sent Emperor Huizong and his whole imperial family marching on a one-way trip north to some of the coldest parts of Heilongjiang to live out the rest of their lives. And this was after the Song had helped the Qin rulers get rid of the Khitans. The Song, for all their assistance, soon after got theirs from the Qin. And these defeated Khitans were forced to migrate out of their conquered lands. And of those Khitans who carried out this exodus from their Mongolian steppe lands northeast of China were the people who became the Kara Khitai, who famously gave us the word Cathay, one of the old names for China used by many nations. And the successor state that they built was also known as the Western Liao. The leader who led them from their ancestral homeland to the new promised land out in Xinjiang, Transoxiana, and later beyond those lands, was the last Liao Dynasty emperor, Dezong, also known as Ye Liu Da Shi. After a hard drubbing by the Jurchen Jin, Ye Liu Da Shi and his Khitan followers beat a retreat to the west and created a new destiny out in those parts. Ye Liu Da Shi led his Khitan followers from their conquered homeland in the direction of Xinjiang, and wherever they passed along the way, they gathered followers, not necessarily Khitan, and they grew in size. And when they came upon the Kocho Uyghur Kingdom, they were welcomed and accepted as the suzerain of this Uyghur Kingdom. These Kara Khitai were quite a warlike people and had battled their way all the way west to the Karakhanid Khanate. And they put an end to the eastern Karakhanids in 1134. 3 years later, in 1137, the Kara Khitai finished up their conquest of the lands in present-day Xinjiang, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. And the empire built by the Kara Khitai, like everyone else in harm's way, lasted till the time of the Mongol conquest. The Kara Khitai themselves did little to assimilate with their new conquered lands. They wrapped themselves up in all the traditional Khitan trappings that they brought with them. Western Liao royalty drew heavily on the inspiration of the Khitan Liao, and from China as well. You know, think what they might of their sedentary Chinese southern neighbors. Most of these northern nomadic tribes, kingdoms, and khaganates loved to spiff up their dynasty with the occasional Chinese title or symbol of authority. So there was plenty going on right now. Contemporary with the Kara Khitai were the Western Xia, the Jurchen Jin Dynasty, the Southern Song, and the Dali Kingdom going on in Yunnan. China was by no means even close to being united. It's going to take the Mongols to take care of that during the Yuan Dynasty. After bringing the Karakhanid Khanate to an end, the Kara Khitai ruled their empire from one of their five power centers, Balasagun, east of Bishkek in present-day Kyrgyzstan. This had been the capital of the eastern Karakhanids before they moved it to Kashgar. All the vassals who once bowed to the Karakhanids now belonged to the Kara Khitai, including the Kocho Uyghur Kingdom. The Karakhanids, after becoming vassals of the Kara Khitai, made themselves useful in helping to control and manage the Muslim portions of the empire. The Kara Khitai were predominantly Buddhist, but maintained good relations with their Karakhanid Muslim subjects. The Western Liao, these Kara Khitai, they were notoriously hands-off suzerains. The Kocho Uyghur state, even after becoming subjects of the Kara Khitai, remained rather independent. As long as the tribute flowed and the obeisance was paid, the Uyghurs up in Kocho were left alone to do their thing. It was like this with all the vassal states. They all enjoyed a similar degree of autonomy. And these Uyghurs who inhabited this Kocho kingdom, they were very literate and had become the true ears to the Sogdian talent for administration and management, not to mention in literature. And in this respect, as I believe I may have indicated in a previous episode, the Uyghurs ended up playing a very significant role in the Mongol Empire. The Karakitai? Now, they lasted till 1218. That's when Genghis Khan put them away. They had tried and failed to retake lands that they had lost to the Jurchen Jin Dynasty. In 1209, these Uyghurs of the Kocho Kingdom, led by their Idikut, what they called their Khans, well, he rose up against their Karakitai overlords, decapitated their leader, and ended up upgrading their loyalties to the Mongols, becoming vassals to Genghis Khan. And this Uyghur Idikut, named Barchuk, for his loyalty to the great Khan, he received in 1211 the hand in marriage of one of the Khan's daughters, and was also given further honors by being called the fifth son of Genghis Khan. You all know the great Khan's four well-known sons from his loyal wife Berte, Jochi, Chagatai, Ergadai, and Tolui. The Uyghur Idikut, Barchuk, who swore fealty to Genghis Khan so early in the game, he was given great honors. Barchuk went on to fight with Genghis Khan deep into Central Asia, and was with him fighting against the Tanguts of the Western Xia, exacting Uyghur revenge for the defeat of the Uyghur Ganzhou Kingdom in Gansu. This was the campaign in 1227 in which Genghis Khan perished in the city of Yinchuan, modern-day capital of Ningxia province. After the Mongol conquest, we don't hear much from the Karakitai, and they just melted into the Central Asian pot. Chinese historiographers from this time considered the Western Liao dynasty to be legit. I mean, the story of the Karakitai was included as one of the 24 officially sanctioned histories, the Arshishi. This story is contained in the Liaoshi, written during the Yuan dynasty. Well, I mentioned him already several times, so you know the next big thing to happen in Xinjiang history, and Asian and European history, I guess you could say, too, was the rise and fall of the Mongol Empire. Things will never be the same after that. I mentioned Genghis Khan's four sons. Well, in 1227, when Genghis Khan died, his four sons took over control of the empire, the first empire that geographically contained the entirety of the Silk Road, all under one umbrella at last. Of the four Khanates created, the one we're concerned with is the one handed over to the number two son of Genghis Khan, and this was Chagatai. These lands of the Chagatai Khanate included most of Central Asia and parts of northern Iran, or basically everything that had once belonged to the Karakitai. Their capital was located in Xinjiang, in the present-day city of Yining, located in the Yili Valley, not too far from the Xinjiang-Kazakhstan border. And rather than get things started with the Chagatayids of the Chagatai Khanate, let's call it a day and bring the curtain down right here. Okay, several listeners have told me I need to put this announcement to sign up to support the show at the beginning of the episode. I don't know, I really don't want to give you the hard sell. $3 a month is all I'm asking, but many of you have signed up for $5 and $10 a month. Is that appreciation or what? Patreon.com/China History Podcast. That's all you need to look for. You can also just do a one-time donation and be rid of me. All you have to do is go to paypal.me/China History Podcast. Throw a few Kyrgyz sum in my online begging bowl, and I'll be most thankful. It's the thought that counts. Thanks, everyone, who has been so kind and generous with the donations. Okay, one last thing. If you haven't listened to all 7 episodes of the special 10-year anniversary program I produced in between Part 7 and this Part 8 episode, go check it out. Some of the best stuff to come out of me this month. It looks at the history of U.S.-China relations between 1969 to 1972, culminating in the royal visit in 1972 of our 36th president, Richard Milhouse Nixon. Quite a controversial character in his day. Go binge on that. Over 2 hours of me, your humble narrator. You know, I have a website, teacup.media. All the links to Patreon, PayPal, every CHP show I ever did, all 30 episodes of the Chinese Sayings podcast from 2016, 2017. It's all there. You know, Cathay Pacific still carries a bunch of those Chinese Sayings shows in their in-flight entertainment system. I am drowning in royalty checks. Everything's there, plus all the links and terms from each episode in pinyin, Chinese, and English. Teacup.media Media. Okay, take care, me little beauties. Keep your friends close and your mask and gloves closer. We're still not out of the woods yet. This is Laszlo Montgomery signing off from the city that made SoCal famous, Los Angeles. You've already come this far, so you might as well join me next time for another exciting episode of the China History Podcast.